A world of wonder awaits at Nemacolin. The Grand Lodge will surprise and delight with 56 stunning suites and 5-star butler services. Indulge in libations at the Circle Bar and Study before you savor the new and enchanting Fawn and Fable restaurant, where the best parts of a traditional steakhouse and a fairy tale castle create a magical dining experience. With fine dining, a spa, and over 100 adventures, golf, art, and wildlife experiences, whatever your imagination holds, Nemacolin has the key. Visit Nemacolin.com for more information.
The following is a CNA podcast.
This is The Climate Conversations, and I'm Jamie Ho. In Singapore, a premium is placed on homes or offices with sweeping views, floor-to-ceiling glass panels, and of course, location, location, location. It would seem, however, that how green and sustainable buildings could be will soon become a corporate priority. Does a building have sustainable architecture? Will it be a net zero building? Will it be resilient to the worsening weather impacts of climate change? These are now urgent questions being asked in the real estate sector. Yet this transformation will take time, and it will cost developers, governments, and owners billions of dollars. And so another question therefore is, just how much are the people and organizations which live or work in these buildings be willing to pay? What will the built environment in Singapore look like in a climate-changed future? What lies in the gap between commitments and execution, and how far will efforts go in reducing emissions as the country races to fulfill its Green Plan obligations? To discuss this with me is a former veteran civil servant in Singapore who has been in charge of key agencies from PUB, Singapore's Water Authority, to holding senior positions at URA, the Urban Redevelopment Authority, and others. Khoo Teng Chai is a civil engineer by training and is currently Asia-Pacific Chair at the Urban Land Institute. Welcome, Teng Chai.
Thank you, Jamie.
Let me start by asking a question that's, you know, really personal to Holder, and that's you. You were chief planner at URA, right, in the early to mid-1990s, and you held several other important positions. Were there any things that you or the URA did then that now, you know, on hindsight, you'd say, in the name of sustainability, a lower footprint, climate adaptation, etc., you would have done, you know, significantly differently?
That's hard to answer. But I guess the strength of Singapore is that we do long-term planning. So when it was URA, we were already looking far ahead, thinking about various things that could happen to Singapore in a long-term plan, which is called the concept plan. And then more related, I guess, to the subject of our conversation was my stint at PUB, right? I spent 8 years at PUB. PUB, you know, is all about water. Most people think about the water scarcity issue, which is a very important issue. But at that time, we were beginning to start worrying about climate change. And climate change, of course, has a lot of impact on water, right? Rising sea level, drought, and flooding. We were already at that time trying to understand the impacts of water on Singapore. Maybe those are the kind of things that, you know, if we had started earlier, it might be better. But I think the knowledge at that time was still very, very scarce. People were still trying to grapple with the water impacts of climate change.
The thing about URA, as you said as well, is that you are so used to these long-term concept plans, right? And you do look very significantly into the future as part of that. In that sense, going back into our conversation, the real estate urban built environment has changed quite dramatically as well, not just in terms of the homes or offices that are built, but also, as you and I know, greater awareness and better technology that has come about making everyone now greener and greener. Share with us as well then what you've seen that has changed most dramatically, you know, from the time you were there till now, as you, and especially now as you can take a more bird's eye view. How much of it has been builders, architects, building owners, and developers sort of reacting to demand on the one hand, and how much of it also has been themselves, all these players anticipating shifts in the global and local sector as well?
People are beginning to realize how important climate change is impacting cities and buildings. Firstly, cities, right? And that's what URA Urban Land Institute is all about. You know, 50% of the world now live in cities, and that number is going to rise to 70%. And in fact, in the Asia-Pacific region, some of the fastest growing cities are in our part of the world. And in fact, many of them are coastal cities, so they are very much impacted by climate change. You know, we've seen a lot of rapid growth, But I think people are beginning to realize that the cities that have developed so fast in the last several decades are vulnerable to a lot of risks from climate change. And so the real estate industry is now taking the whole business of climate change a lot more seriously. So if you look at buildings, for example, we expect the building stock to double, actually, you know, globally, right, to double by the year 2060. And in fact, one third of buildings are at risk from climate impacts like flooding. So I think the real estate industry internationally and in Asia Pacific are beginning to take the whole challenges, you know, that are posed by climate change, both in terms of mitigation as well as adaptation, very, very seriously. It's no longer just about public relations, right? It's no longer what they call greenwashing. In fact, a recent ULI Emerging Trends survey showed that 3/4 of those who are investing in real estate now take environmental and social governance, ESG, as an important or even a mandatory factor when they are looking at investment. So that's what's happening now in terms of the changing attitude towards climate change in cities, and buildings are a great part of it.
Let me ask you as well. I mean, I wonder whether the last 2 years of COVID and countries and cities around the world dealing with the pandemic, dealing with lockdown and isolation and working from home, you put that together with this concept, as we've all known, of urbanization, urban growth, growth of cities. Has there been a reimagining of what it actually means for traditional concepts like urbanization and city growth, knowing now that actually a lot of people who used to flock to cities, and that's a big source of growth and dynamism, that sort of changes things a little bit? And does that allow a little bit more creativity in going green, perhaps, within cities?
This way, maybe I can say a little bit more about the Urban Land Institute, because there's a kind of issues that the ULI is particularly concerned about. It is actually the world's largest real estate organization. It's very multi-stakeholder, you know, it's not just real estate developers, it's real estate developers, investors, consultants, even public officials like myself. So it's very, very multidisciplinary, very international, 45,000 strong globally and in Asia Pacific. And in fact, the ULI has put sustainability, net zero, you know, as well as housing and learning as its three mission priorities. And in Asia Pacific, it is kind of one of the most rapidly urbanizing parts of the world. And here, as in everywhere else, sustainability is a key priority. And we know that the pandemic, in fact, is one of the key things that have impacted us in the last 2 or 3 years. And so the ULI, like everybody else, has had to pivot to a different way of working. We have to work virtually. We have had to have, you know, instead of major conferences, people coming together, we have had to have virtual and hybrid conferences. And one of the key issues that we keep on talking about, everybody keeps on talking about, is as a result of the pandemic, how will cities change? How will we design buildings? There's been so much discussion. And we know, for example, that the role of the central business districts in many cities will now change, because a lot of people no longer work in the downtown during the pandemic. Many people work from home. The question is, even when the pandemic is over, will people ever return to the central business district in the numbers that they used to? The jury is still out. Different organizations are doing their assessment. Some are going hybrid. Some are kind of requiring their staff go back, you know, 3 days a week. Some are leaving it to their staff. So things are still playing out, but certainly we are going to see urban planners rethinking about the way cities are planned. CBDs are still going to be important, but perhaps more important will be what happens, you know, in the suburban cities. In Singapore, what happens in our towns, which are HDB towns, primarily residential? Maybe we are going to see more people working from homes and in suburban offices. So these are the kind of trends which are going to impact cities. Also, public transport, right? Fewer people took crowded public transport, you know, during the pandemic. So how would the way we plan for public transport change, right? Will we encourage more alternatives? For example, encouraging more cycling, more walking, there's a trend towards what is called 15-minute cities, right? In Singapore, in fact, we call it one-minute cities because, you know, vertical villages or vertical kampongs like Kampong Admiralty. And that will change, again, the character of cities. So it's a whole issue of what I would call urban resilience, right? So the whole idea of responding to climate change is that you need to adapt to the changes that are happening as a result of climate change. And then your ability to adapt, either in the short term or in the long run, to urban planning and infrastructure is what I would call urban resilience. Increasingly, cities will have to look at livability, they have to look at sustainability, and they have to look at resilience.
I like the term that you use, urban resilience, because, you know, things are evolving so quickly as well, as we've seen in the last 2 years with the pandemic, with these changing models of work and potentially a fundamental shift in the concept of the CBD, right? If I were therefore a developer, an investor, building owner who's already had resources invested into the CBDs of today, then you see the twin challenges that you have: climate change, mitigation, adaptation, now changing models of work. Give me an idea of some of the sort of groundbreaking already. I mean, obviously, it's still very early days yet, but I'm sure that there has to be a lot of innovation in terms of what they're trying to conceive of. If I'm, again, an investor, an owner, what's the next 5-10 years going to look like for them?
Investors, owners are now taking these issues very, very seriously, more from the mitigation as well as adaptation. So ULI, for example, has a center for sustainability, and within that center, a Green Print Center. So the Green Print Center is really all about bringing different stakeholders together to look at how we can achieve decarbonization at the building level. Their target is to halve carbon emissions by 2030 and to work towards net zero by 2050. And in fact, some building owners, for example, in New York, the Empire State Building, in Singapore, some of our developers, the university, for example, are working on various, you know, milestone achieving type of buildings. So, for example, NUS, right, National University of Singapore, which I'm part of, has a plan to become net zero by the year 2030. And in fact, NUS is a pioneer in a net zero building in the School of Design and Environment, the faculty, the Department of Architecture. It's called the School of Design and Environment Building 4. That's a net zero building. And that was built from scratch with all these principles of using more mechanical ventilation, much more efficient air conditioning with solar panels on the roof. But it's not just about building new buildings. Some of the existing buildings in NUS, the what you call SDE 1 to 3, through retrofitting, they've also been able to achieve almost net zero. That is very important because most of the buildings are our existing building stock, whether it's in Singapore or other cities in Asia or the world. Many of the buildings were built 20, 30, 40 years ago, or maybe 100 years ago, and some of them are still, you know, doing well. You know, so instead of pulling them down and rebuilding, which will actually use up a lot more carbon, by retrofitting, it is actually a very effective low-carbon solution towards net zero. So retrofitting, I think, is one of the areas where I think a lot of innovation is taking place. So that's on the kind of mitigation side, if you like, lowering carbon. Now, if you look at adaptation, which is how are we responding to climate change, especially flooding, right? Not just flooding, but, you know, urban heat island effect, drought, you know, increasing typhoons, hurricanes. Developers are building buildings for the next 30, 50 years, or they want to see their buildings last for the next 30 to 50 years. So they are, of course, concerned about all these climate events or the increasing risk of a climate event, you know, flooding their basement. And if their equipment, expensive equipment, are not solid in the basement, lots of damage is going to be done. So this is an issue that the ULI and my former center, the Center for Livable Cities, was very interested in. So we started a research project called Building Resilience in Cities. So we brought together 5 cities, Singapore, Hong Kong, Rotterdam, Miami, and New York. And we got especially the private sector to work with the city officials to look at how the real estate industry, the private sector, represented by primarily the ULI members, can work together to make our buildings more resilient to climate change. And the result is a publication that the ULI and CLC put up and distilled this into 10 principles drawn from the examples of these five cities, practical examples, and they distilled 10 principles, you know, under the headings of envision, empower, and execute. Very practical principles of how cities can adapt to climate change. And this is the sort of initiatives I think we're going to see a lot more, not just from ULI, but I guess from, you know, many other stakeholders.
You raised some very, very interesting points. And I want to jump back on the issue of existing buildings and retrofitting. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in Singapore, we've already since 2005 had this BCA Green Mark scheme. We've sort of been on a little bit of a front foot as far as that's concerned. But I would imagine, for example, that a building in 2005 being green might be quite different from something that you would say is green in 2025. And, you know, retrofitting obviously is, as you say, a very low carbon solution to older buildings. That then brings into me the issue of cost ultimately. I mean, cost is prevalent in all the decisions that developers and architects and all that think about. As you look into the studies, as your institute looks into the studies, obviously retrofitting, especially for older buildings, is going to be expensive. There's a cost involved. What's your take on the willingness of people to absorb that kind of cost, recognize that kind of cost, and ultimately consumers, right? The people who live there, the people who work there. Is there a greater acceptance that there will be these inbuilt costs as buildings retrofit, as they even put in new developments and new technologies? Is that something that's widely accepted already within the industry?
It's beginning to happen. If you ask the same question 5 years ago, or you say 2005, those were early days, right?
Sure, yeah.
But what is amazing is that things have changed very, very rapidly over the last 2 years. I've kind of almost felt it, right?
Really? Okay, yeah.
Even like 3 years ago, I think people were kind of taking these issues like not something very top of the mind. But in the last 1 or 2 years, suddenly these kind of issues have become and almost top of the agenda, right? Maybe it's because of the pandemic. Maybe it's because people are seeing a lot more climate events, you know, flooding or wildfires and so on. And so investors, developers, users are taking all these issues a lot more seriously. So I mentioned the investors, right? So they are taking it seriously, making it a very important criteria for this, making investment decisions. Developers, likewise, are looking at how do they build to the new standards, whether it is the BCA standards. You know, in fact, BCA is requiring all government buildings to achieve beyond Green Mark Platinum, right? I think they have now these new standards for super low energy buildings. Likewise, internationally, the LEED standards are what increasingly developers are working towards. And users, the kind of informed, educated, you know, more sophisticated users, like, you know, big companies, are now insisting that the buildings that they move into are buildings that are climate resilient, they are of the right standard. So I think it's happening. And then you're beginning to see, you know, new kinds of initiatives, you know, green bonds, you know, developers doing super low energy buildings. So these are the things that are really, you know, all of a sudden you're seeing this accelerating in a pretty kind of noticeable sort of way.
We'll take a quick break and be right back. The Climate Conversations podcast is supported by Sabana Jurong, Building Cities, Shaping Lives. Let me dive into a little bit of the, so to speak, nuts and bolts of the greening journey for the built and urban sector. As you say, urbanization is not going to stop. In fact, it's going to grow. Cities are going to get bigger. And buildings, as we hope, they will anticipate and will become greener and greener as we go along. But if you look at how they're built, just right as upstream as we can in the supply chain, you know, things like steel and cement, notorious when it comes to emissions, right? Yet, you know, as we say, the demand for the built environment is going to grow. Give us a sense of, therefore, whether or not builders, developers, owners are even looking all the way upstream and seeing where do we get our steel from. Is it the top of the class, low emissions, cement, different types of materials even? I've had past conversations on this podcast talking about, could we even look into more renewable supply, right? Wood, for example, is something which has been forgotten after a while. But is this also something that people are getting more and more concerned about, not just in terms of emissions and mitigation, but also reputationally, that they need to be sure that the way that buildings are built is greener as well?
That's certainly something that developers are looking at. And I think investors are also watching developers in terms of both the way they build or develop their buildings, as well as the way they manage and operate their buildings. So when you talk about the type of materials that are used in the buildings, then it's really in part of the building or development process. When you look at emissions, there's this scope 1, scope 2, scope 3, right? That goes all the way into looking at what is called embedded carbon, right? So in other words, from the choice of materials, then you're actually putting a lot of carbon into the building even before you start using it. So these are things that people are looking very carefully, how you design your building to be as low carbon as possible. So certainly considering different types of materials is one of the options. And that's where the Green Print Center of ULI comes in. The service that Green Print Center is offering to developers, to ULI members actually, including cities, is the Green Print Center brings expertise as well as practical experience, right? From developers who have done it, from experts, and then bring that experience to bear on a particular city or a particular set of or development, either at the city level or development level, and spend a bit of time, maybe 3 to 5 days, providing what is called advisory services, right? In ULI, we call it the advisory services panel. And that ASP actually brings together a bunch of experts to interact with, you know, the local developers, the officials, to look at, okay, what are the strategies that they can adopt or specific, you know, ideas that they can adapt from other cases elsewhere in the world to be able to create more low carbon buildings. So in fact, right now in Asia Pacific, we are looking at 1 or 2 cities in China where we are going to introduce this ASP by the Green Print Center for creating low carbon buildings, right? So that's something that I think is a very strong ULI initiative under one of our 3 mission priorities that I talked about earlier.
On that front, does the ULI therefore also ensure that specific buildings or developers pledge a net zero goal, right? I mean, the net zero goal obviously is something that is very easy to digest and very easy to commit to in a way. What's the role that your institute has in ensuring that these commitments are also, so to speak, kosher, that they have the data, that they have the basis on which to make it, and it's sort of trackable and they are reviewable and credible as well? Do you think that's a role that institutes or other third parties increasingly have to play when we do have people making such pledges?
For ULI, we are called an Urban Land Institute because we are really about sharing knowledge through our community. So the way we share knowledge, the advisory services panel is one way. After we do each project, it is all documented. We do a lot of case studies too. We do a lot of research projects like the one I mentioned with the Center for Livable Cities. All this is kind of captured in this gigantic database. And then we have this ULI knowledge finder that every ULI member can access and can get all this information. You know, we also publish indices on various aspects, and the climate is certainly one of those areas that we will be looking into. So that's, I think, one of the key roles, to be able to kind of capture all that knowledge and then to share it through programs under our learning umbrella, right? Education, learning programs. We have short courses and so on, just to kind of help people, for example, to figure out how to do carbon accounting. How do you calculate the amount of carbon in buildings? So these are the kind of courses that ULI runs for its members. So the case studies, the publications, the courses, and then special advisory services, as well as, of course, through our regular conferences, webinars, and summits. All these are kind of really knowledge sharing platforms that I think the ULI is renowned for, where we bring our members from across different sectors of the real estate industry and across Asia Pacific and the world.
Maybe this is part of your KPI as well, but do you see a competitive peer pressure happening amongst your members as well, both within Singapore and maybe in the wider region, that, you know, through platforms such as yours, there is a competitiveness that people want to do more. They see what else people are doing and they know where the bar is at and they need to cross that bar. Is that the kind of dynamic involved?
I think so, because when you hear, for example, at our webinars or conferences that, oh, XYZ company is doing this to ABC building, it's very motivating for those who are learning about that example. And you use the word competitive, but I use the more positive word, motivating them to kind of, okay, you know, if they can do it and they can show the economics of it, that it's not just spending a lot of money and not getting a return. Many of them are private sector members, so they're very interested in the long-term, you know, they're in kind of financial return as well as social and environmental outcomes. They do appreciate this kind of sharing amongst members. After all, at the end of the day, you know, the ULI's mission is really to shape the future of the built environment to create more vibrant communities worldwide. It's a very lofty mission, really, but the members of the ULI come together because they all believe that we are not just about putting our building, but we want to make sure that our building is part of the broader urban community, that we can contribute positively towards better urban planning, urban design, and ultimately to contribute to better cities, more livable, more sustainable, more resilient.
Yeah, so if I could, as a sort of a last question, then bring our conversation back to Singapore and back to yourself, using your lens to look through it. I mean, you've had a very long and interesting career now at the ULI as well, and you've seen the way that Singapore has grown very, very, very significantly, almost, you know, in an unprecedented way globally in the last years. Obviously, you know, that there will be critics who say that all this has come at a sort of environmental sustainability cost. What's your take on that? And, you know, and looking forward, what we've already done so far and what things like the Singapore Green Plan have pledged and committed to do, what do you see the urban sort of sector, both within the traditional CBD and the suburban areas? What's a nice balance between growth and growth via the built and urban sector? Will the pandemic sort of allow us as well an opportunity to regroup, restock what our city is going to look like and the kind of growth that it's going to have in the next decade to 5 decades, perhaps?
I think Singapore has been able to, over, I think, the last 5-6 decades, been able to achieve a certain degree of livability, sustainability, and resilience, in spite of the fact that we are just a tiny little island. 5-6 decades ago, when I was a kid, we were less than 2 million people. And yet we had all the problems of urbanization gone wrong, right? We had slums, we had traffic congestion, we had polluted rivers, we had droughts, and we had flooding and crime and disease. But 5-6 decades later, you know, today, our population is now 5.5 million. So it's tripled on the same island. So in terms of sustainability, right, in terms of trying to kind of make the best use of very, very, very limited resource, we have done reasonably well, right? We've been, you know, we've achieved quite good livability. We've been quite environmentally sustainable, and we are resilient so far. In ours, I think it's a kind of a interesting model. I mean, at the Center for Livable Cities, I spent 10 years trying to distill the principles that got Singapore to where we are today. We call it the livability framework, where at the end of the day, you want to achieve livability outcomes of quality of life, competitive economy, sustainable environment. We've been able to achieve that with good governance and integrated approach of planning. I call it an urban systems approach. That's a course I'm teaching right now at the NUS, right? To a newer generation of urban leaders, right? But I think the principles are not just unique to Singapore. I think the principles apply to many rapidly growing cities in Asia Pacific and elsewhere. They're all growing very quickly and they have to grow. People want to kind of all gravitate toward the center. But then the land, you know, resources are scarce.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it well, then you will become unlivable and unsustainable, like what we did. You know, what happened to us 5-6 decades ago. And today, you know of cities that are still struggling. But some cities are doing well. Singapore is one of those where we've been able to achieve high livability with high density. That makes us, you know, livable, sustainable, resilient. But going forward, that's going to be the challenge. Climate change is going to hit us. We are an island, low lying. We have demographic changes. There could be more problems like the pandemic. There are still many, many unknowns ahead. So how are we going to face those challenges? Not just Singapore, but all other cities in the world. I think that's where institute like the Urban Land Institute is so very important for all of us who are the urban leaders, if you like, the professionals, the investors, the users, and really also the community at large. To get together, you know, in this kind of a platform to share knowledge, you know, to undertake kind of new research, to share case studies with each other, so that we can all progressively, hopefully, create a better future for the world, a more positive future where hopefully we can tackle the problems, the challenges of climate change. It's very, very challenging. We all know that. The clock is running against us, but I'm an optimist and I think we will find the good solution. And I think you and I can be at the forefront of all of this.
Well, Khoo Teng Chye, certainly challenging times ahead, but as you say, hopefully it's also exciting times ahead for all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie. It was nice talking to you.
And thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on cna.asia. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Aaron Low. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.
If you've been hurt by a truck, you can call Colombo Law 24/7 and we'll be there to make sure you're taken care of. When someone is hurt by a truck, Colombo Law is the law firm people call to get answers. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.